Please be seated. This morning I'm going to be drawing from two writers, and I want to give them credit because I don't often steal material, but I am today. So the first one's name is Peter Bailey, and he's written a book called Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, and he gives some context for this parable that we don't often have in the West. In the Middle East, When a wedding feast is going to begin, a wedding takes place after the banquet. And so the groom starts in his hometown or his side of the village, and he gathers there and prepares there with all of his friends. And they all gather and they have a party, and then they come to the site of wherever they're going to live or the bride's family for the wedding banquet. So it could be some delay. As you can imagine, a bunch of teenage boys getting together with an excuse to party. And then they arrive, and then the wedding banquet begins when the groom arrives, which is kind of the opposite of most of the weddings that I've done. We usually end up waiting on the bride to finish her hair. Thankfully, we don't have to wait on bachelor parties these days. So while they're waiting, kind of to show the virtue of the bride and the virtue of the bridesmaids, they would wait often into the night with oil lamps, which were meant to be kept lit whenever you were out and about in the city, not because in most of these villages it was unsafe, but rather it was a little unseemly to be sneaking around at night. You could get a bad reputation that way. So having a lamp was an essential part of sort of the bridesmaid's gear. So the story is a story of feasting and of being welcome. And I didn't mention it at the 8 o'clock service. Someone asked. So I thought I'd tell you Peter Bailey's best line about this parable, which is that specifically in this parable, it doesn't cast the bridesmaids out into the outer darkness. You know, we're in the terrible parables of Matthew. So we've had a number of parables where people get cast out into the outer darkness. And it's easy to kind of see this as an utter dismissal of them. But in this case, it's not true. There's no outer darkness. There's no gnashing of teeth. There is instead, as Peter Bailey says, the assumption that this is the beginning of a debate. For if you've ever been in a bartering culture, you know that no never means no. It just tells you where we're going to start from. So what does this parable have to do with us? I always have a fundamental question that kind of keeps me awake at night, and that is, what does it mean to be a Christian, and how do I become one? You'd think this would be odd as a priest, but I have to teach this stuff every week. And we have a lot of options. And all this year, as we've talked about discipleship, I've hovered back around this idea of virtues. And I give a lot of credit to that for Bishop N.T. Wright out of Durham, although now he's in Scotland teaching in a university. This idea of that we have to develop virtues. Because we talk about a loving God, we worship a loving God, we love a loving God, and we say that if we're going to be the children of that God, that we have to love others. But that's tough. People make it difficult to love them. Life makes it difficult to remain loving. And if we are going to last into the night, we have to become wise. And you become wise one choice at a time. You become virtuous one decision at a time. So I'm going to steal from Tom Wright this example from his book, After You Believe, which humorously enough in Great Britain was called something like The Virtuous Life. And he brought it to his American publisher and he said, I can never sell that in the United States. You can't sell a book with virtue in the title here. So they came up with After You Believe, and he took that title back to his British publisher and he said, you can't sell that here. It's a book about losing your faith. It sold really well. So he gives this wonderful example. Do you remember this event in the news a couple of years ago called the Miracle on the Hudson? Sully Sullenberg lands a plane on the Hudson in the middle of New York. It's a great story, and they called it the Miracle on the Hudson. And it's a perfect example of sort of the Western mind about virtue and sort of the utter mistake that we make. And we called it a miracle The miracle wasn't that he was able to do it. This was a man who taught other pilots what to do in times of crisis. He had been through this scenario tens of thousands of times. He had spent hours, thousands of hours in the cockpit rehearsing this scenario, teaching other people what to do. And not only that, in his spare time, he was a glider pilot, which means he spent a lot of time flying big aircraft with no power. The miracle was that he was the pilot. If you're the guy in 7C, when the geese hit the plane, your prayer is, please God, let there be a man in the cockpit who has spent his entire life flying glider planes and then teaching crisis piloting to others. Although it probably doesn't come out quite that calmly, right? That's the guy you want. Why? Because he has been through it over and over and over again. In times when there was no crisis, in times when there was crisis, he shut off the power on more planes than most of us will ever fly in. That's the guy you want. And I would say that's the person that you want to be. We always think of virtues, for some reason, as sort of a miracle. We're surprised when people make it through difficult times or develop the character to be generous or they're hospitable to their own cost. But you don't decide that in the crisis. You don't become something. A virtue is something that you do day in and day out. You form habits. And life, another line I'm stealing from N.T. Wright, vices will choose you. Virtues are something you have to choose. When you go with how you feel all the time, you develop vices. You have to actually choose to become a virtuous person. So you choose day in and day out. And if you're going to list a list of Christian virtues, in Galatians there's a wonderful little list we call the fruits of the Spirit. And it is a powerful thing to begin to think about, how do I embody this calling to be a child of God? What virtues, what habits of being do I want to develop over the course of my life of discipleship? And I can tell you this has been a real question that's nagged me for the last couple of years as I've been preparing for and then preaching for this last year on discipleship. One of the things that sort of has stuck with me is there are some virtues I don't have. And it's easy to say that it's like creativity or the ability to run a 5-second 40-yard dash. I just don't have it, and I ain't going to have it. You just got to put up with me. I'm not a generous person. I'm not hospitable. That's me. Deal with it. And there's a lot that would support that way of thinking. But I'm going to take an example of two virtues, and I'm not going to steal these from anybody else. I'm going to tell you they're struggles of mine. One is hospitality. I'm not unhospitable by nature, but I spend all of my time in a job where I have to see a lot of people. And I often see people when they're not at their best. It can make one sort of self-protective when you get home. Steve calls my office the fishbowl. And so when I go home, I've made a habit of not reaching out enough. And some geese hit the engines of our neighborhood last month when Amy was pointing out as we were going to bed that there were two ambulances sitting on our street and they were wheeling off one of our neighbors. And I didn't remember her name. Couldn't remember her name. And it drove me nuts. Because I realized that here I am preaching week after week about loving my neighbor, and yet I hadn't reached out enough to remember who she was in a moment of crisis. It was sort of the Sully Sullenberg moment if it had taken place during the movie Airplane 2. My interior pilot is running around, screaming, sweating, and flipping switches with no clue where the landing gear is. So I've been making small decisions. Because I learned as a runner that sometimes you have to start over. So working on the virtue of hospitality doesn't begin with throwing a feast for 75 people. It begins with extending my raking line over a few yards. Stopping to say hello. Watching my neighbor get out of the car with groceries and offering to lend a hand. All she wanted was someone to close the trunk, and that was enough. It's doing more than waving, it's walking over to say hello. But I realized that if I'm going to land the plane, I've got to start doing some practice. The second virtue is honesty, because I am a parent. And for those of you who are parents in the room, I am about to say something painful, but you know that I'm telling the truth, and that is that we lie to our kids all the time. Don't we? It's for their own good. It's not for our good, though. And, nope, the TV just broke. Time to go to bed. I'll fix it when you're asleep. I've been working on, over the last year, telling my kids the truth no matter what, or just telling them I can't tell them. Or just dealing with what no means, which, if you have a three-year-old, can be the equivalent of just punching the red button and seeing what happens, you know? If virtues were easy, they'd be vices. You make the choice day in and day out. Now, what does all this have to do with a baptism? We baptize a child and pray and believe that they will be indwelt by the Holy Spirit, that Hayden will be brought into the covenant relationship under a family, under a community of Christ that gathers week in and week out to proclaim we are the body of Christ. We're a family of believers. But in order to really hold that out in our lives, we can't just go with how we feel day in and day out. We can't go with sort of the lowest common moral denominator, and I can't live by what the shampoo commercials are telling me. I've got to step into a real and honest life of discipleship. And it's going to mean decisions that hurt. But we can't expect her to grow up to be something that we're unwilling to plug away at day after day. That's why we ask parents to take a parenting class for baptism. It's why we don't do vacation baptisms. It's why I don't do total strangers. We're making a covenant with the child and with God that we are going to do something with her life that really matters. And I can tell you as a parent, man, I demand stuff of my kids that keep me awake at night because then I have to live with it myself. And if I want this girl to last through the nights that are sure to come, and they will, if I want her to be awake when the party starts and to know what it is to celebrate in the joy of the Lord, I got to teach her how to fill up her oil bottles. And I got to remind her every single time, all of us, we can't leave that burden to Steve and Linda and Jackson and Catherine all to themselves. We're a community. We designate godparents, but when Steve and I were talking about the baptism of Hayden, we talked a lot about that if Steve could really do it, he would make the whole church her godparents. That's the mind that slips around the backside with extra oil. We are asked in these promises to be more than we set out to be when we started waiting for this party. So when we do this baptism today, I want you to join in with everything but the first line of presentation by the godparents. Join in the recommitting ourselves to our own baptismal covenant. And if you've never done that and you want to know how to do it, Easter's coming, baby. And I'll get you wet. It's the best joy in the priesthood. Are you ready?
Yes.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Let's have a baptism.